I call this meeting of Labor and Industry Finance and Policy to order for Thursday, April 11th. And Representative Isaacs, I see you're peering at the minutes. Do they look like they were done properly?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the committee minutes from April 4th, excuse me, April 9th. Thank you, April 9th.
The minutes, the motions were made to approve the minutes from April 9th. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Moves are approved, or the minutes are approved. We've got three bills on the agenda today. And first bill up is House File 3439. Welcome to the committee, Representative Ream. I'll move the House File 3439 be laid over for possible inclusion. You want to explain your bill?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Nelson, committee members. And I also have an amendment here. I could move to amend.
I'll move the 824-0254 amendment to move to put this bill in the order that the author wants. All in favor of the 824 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. So go ahead and explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, committee. So this bill is about getting Minnesota ready for the dramatic growth in electric vehicles we are sure to see in the next 5 to 20 years. EV charging takes place at home, and lack of access to home charging is a significant barrier to EV adoption. Further, it is far more expensive to retrofit a parking garage for EV charging stations than to include such capacity when the structure is originally built. And I do have a number of testifiers here, including an electrician from IBEW, and would love to have them testify in support.
I have a list of testifiers. First one on my list is Andy Snope. Welcome to the committee. Please, and you know the committee, you know the rules, state your name before you speak and begin with your testimony.
All right. Thank you, Chair Nelson. My name is Andy Snope. I'm with the IBEW. We represent electrical workers, electricians in this case. We're supportive of this bill because obviously it could give some work to electricians, and that's what our focus is. One thing that we're a little concerned about is being too prescriptive in code. We think that code should be written by the experts who work with that. And that typically consists of the Construction Codes Advisory Council at Mendali or the National Electric Code. We just get worried about legislating code. But with that said, we think that this is a good start to some requirements, which we see in the future as something that homeowners are going to want. As we electrify everything, including vehicles, there's going to be more of a demand for this. So I think kind of the intent here is, at least from what I've heard, is that the infrastructure is provided if the electric panel were not in the garage. So if your electric panel was in your basement, shouldn't there be an easier way to get a circuit from the basement up to the garage to provide an outlet for the EV charging? This would most easily be done as the home is being built. The over-prescriptive part would be, then would this require a larger panel when the house is being built? And I think that expense is probably prohibitive of what we're trying to accomplish. So you'll probably hear other testimony that could be kind of cost prohibitive. And I don't know if that's really the intent, but really we should have a way to make it easier for a future homeowner to upgrade and get that EV charger without tearing apart their home to get that circuit up there. So again, we're supportive, but you know, we're cautious. And I'm happy to answer any questions, any technical questions later.
I just have one question for you now.
Sure.
What is currently, what a new home construction, what is the minimum panel that gets put in a house? As I know, my aunt's house had a 40 amp service, and we had to upgrade it when she sold. Mine's 100 amp in my house. What is it at now?
Yeah, so currently the minimum panel you can have in a dwelling is a 100 amp panel. When I was working out in the field, we used to install a 150 amp panel, which I only found out a couple of weeks ago that they don't do that anymore. So it's either a 100-amp panel or a 200-amp panel is kind of the basic. Some of the larger homes will require more power than that, but the minimum generally is a 100-amp panel.
Thank you, sir. Next person I have on my list, and we may call you back for more questions, is Nick Erickson. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nick Erickson. I'm Senior Director of Housing Policy for Housing First Minnesota. Our members build the communities and places we all call home. I also served on the technical advisory group for the electric vehicle for multifamily and commercial building that was a result of last year's legislation. I want to begin by thanking Representative Ream for the amendment. We've been working with the bill author and other stakeholders for the last several months on the language to this bill. And in, as Mr. Snopes said, this does address kind of some of the confusion that has kind of come up about this bill. Housing First Minnesota is supportive of the change as long as it is more aligned with keeping a conduit or raceway only. Obviously, the oversizing of the panel does get into kind of more of a prescriptive approach that, that we do have concerns with. You know, this is an emerging technology. Not all of these chargers will be used right away. And as we had discussions on our electric vehicle for commercial dwellings, you know, going too far on what the, you know, we cannot today plan for what the future technology is. So having some type of flexibility within our codes to address what the actual need will be at the at a future point in time is something that we would prefer. And again, like Mr. Snope, I can answer any technical questions you may have with this legislation.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Next person I have on the list is Carolyn Berninger. And welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you and good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carolyn Berninger. I'm a public policy manager with the Great Plains Institute, testifying today on behalf of Drive Electric Minnesota. Drive Electric Minnesota is a partnership of electric vehicle champions that's working to electrify transportation in Minnesota. As you've already heard, EV adoption is increasing really rapidly in Minnesota already. Registrations have increased almost 750% just between 2018 and 2023, and that's expected to continue increasing due to supportive state and federal policy like Minnesota's new EV rebate program, the updated federal incentive program, as well as improving vehicle technology and availability, decreasing battery prices, bringing down vehicle costs, and increasing consumer interest. And so with, to support this expected really significant increase in EV adoption going forward on the roads, Minnesota really needs more EV charging in place, particularly at home, where, as you've heard, most EV charging, over 80%, occurs today. And it's particularly important to plan ahead when it comes to new buildings, as any building that's built today is going to be standing for decades. And so we really need to design buildings today to accommodate the needs of both current and future EV owners to prevent a lack of access to charging from becoming a barrier to EV adoption moving forward. It's also very cost effective. Retrofitting is much more expensive than adding charging capabilities later on. In addition to future proofing and lowering costs, investing in Minnesota's EV charging capacity is going to help the state meet its climate and EV adoption goals, making it easier for more Minnesotans to make the switch to an EV. So Drive Electric Minnesota is very supportive of this bill and thankful to Representative Ream for carrying it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the audience that needs to testify for or against this bill? If not, we'll go to the discussion. Representative Mecklen, I think you saw you raise your eyebrows over there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, you looked at me, and I'm like, what the heck? You expected it to come, I imagine. Perhaps Mr. Snope could answer a question for me, too. Thank you, Mr. Snope. So kind of what you touched on, would it not be just as easy to either just simply put the, I hope we have these terms right, but the wiring in place, put the box there, put a blank cap over it, leave it disconnected in the mechanical room so we wouldn't have to upsize the power panel, if particularly if you're talking like a, 11, 12, 1300 square foot house that certainly doesn't need that big of a panel, but in this scenario it would, and that would be question one. Question two, if there are multiple outlets of these, can they be run on one circuit where they have to be individual runs and tails going back?
Mr. Snow.
Yes. Chair Nelson, Representative Mecklen. Yeah, I think that really is kind of the intent, to leave an open conduit from the mechanical room or wherever the electric panel is. In most cases, if it's not in the garage, it's in the basement. So if you ran a conduit from the basement to the garage, did exactly what you said, put a junction box and a cover on it for future use, I think that's really kind of what I have felt is the intent of what we kind of want to do. If you had to upgrade the panel, yes, then it would be a much extra, it'd be a bigger cost to do that on the front end. Whereas in my mind, you could, that cost should really be on the future homeowner that wants to add that circuit. And remind me the other part of the question, the second part.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you had three of these outlets, I'm assuming they're like a 60-amp outlet, would that be fair right in there?
Right.
So could that be all in one circuit, or would it have to be each individual circuit but all through the same conduit?
Mr. Snow.
Yeah, Chair Nelson, Representative Mecklen. Each one of those units would have to be on its own circuit. If you size the conduit accordingly, then you could get all those wires in one conduit, but it would have to be a much larger conduit to accommodate three circuits. Now, I know, because I have a Tesla charger, that you can put a couple of those on one circuit, and internally they communicate with each other, you know, and kind of load share, but very few electric chargers do that at this point, where you could put two on there on one circuit, and they would share that circuit. So really the answer is that for each charging unit, you would need a separate circuit.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So thank you for that. So in your estimation, if we're going to literally put in an oversized panel in a very affordable first-time home, plus you're going to run three individual circuits, because you'd probably run them in Romax, right, because the framing's all open, and then you would put the individual boxes in and either the dummy plates, and then if you connected it all and did it this way, how much additional would that add to the cost of that new home?
Mr. Snow.
Chair Nelson, Representative Mecklen, I can't even really begin to estimate that, because I've heard a number of different estimates for what people are charging now to put in larger panels. But part of your question, when you talk about putting a large Romex in, that can be very expensive. When you put the wire in, the wire is actually the highest cost of that, of those items. By putting a empty conduit in, usually a plastic flexible conduit, that's a much cheaper item. So if you're putting in conduits and circuits and new panels, I mean, it could be thousands of dollars to do. If you're just putting a conduit in from one point to the other, you know, maybe $200 when the home's being built.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's kind of what I'm getting to, that it could all be there and ready to be used should somebody ever choose to use it. And, like, I mean, and in my house we have fish lines that are left in place so we can pull back.
Right.
Because I was smart when I did that, just for that reason. But because, you know, when you take, let's just say arbitrarily it's $3,500, then the general's going to mark that up. Mm-hmm. And you're going to be adding interest to that. And so all these dollar amounts keep compounding, and we constantly hear about a lack of affordable housing. And it's been going on since I got here in 2019, and I don't see it ending anytime soon. And for every 1,000 you increase the home, you're losing 1,000 of potential buyers, particularly the higher the interest rate goes. And like right now, there's like 3% of the population are using, you know, have a need for this. So you were going to force 97% of all those new home buyers to bear all this cost when they may or may not need it in the time in which that is that they live in that particular home. That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ream, you want a response?
Yes, thank you, Chair Nelson. So the reasoning behind this bill is to make it more affordable to have an EV. So this bill is not mandating that we install 200-amp electrical panels. This bill is to make it so it's easier if you want to have an EV and you want to install a circuit in your garage, you would have a shorter, easier access to your electric panel. So I have a couple examples here. I know I've heard stories, and I actually have in my own house, we've been trying to electrify. Our electric panel is in our lower level in a basement, which is pretty much kitty corner from our garage. So for the electrician to be able to install a higher voltage outlet in our garage, he will have to wire or put the conduit, you know, through our lower level, whereas if the house had been designed in a way that the electric panel was closer to our garage, it wouldn't cost that much. So I know I've heard stories of it might cost like upwards of $2,000 or more based on where your electric panel is in relation to your garage. Some people, they have, you know, it's designed really well. They've got the electric panel really close to the garage and it costs like a couple hundred dollars. So this bill helps make it affordable in that it makes, and we'll be working on the language, I think, but it'll make it easier for people to install, you know, the outlet in your garage, because it'll make sure that that electric panel is installed closer to the garage. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? So, I mean, we're not mandating that people install a 200-amp electric panel. That is expensive, but we are wanting to make sure that it's not going to be cost prohibitive to retrofit, you know, if they decide later on that they want to install that. Does that make sense? Hopefully that does.
Representative Mecklen, you're a builder. I know you're a built contractor, and so you understand a lot of this stuff as well as myself.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that was basically what we were just discussing. But if it's going to require there to be functioning ones in there, then you are going to have to automatically shift to the higher amp panel, because the 100 amp panel cannot handle even one of those, I'm guessing, with all the other circuits in the house. I mean, Mr. Snope is nodding his head with me in agreement. So that's why this has to be taken into account, that we're going to be adding this additional cost for something that may never be used. But to put the conduit there makes sense. I mean, that could become part of standard building practice. I mean, we have those types of things we do all the time now as we see trends coming. We don't put phone lines anymore, and we haven't in years. We actually cut them off and patched the wall over. Then it went to Cat 5, and now it's all wireless. But to actually put the functioning outlets in there, and it seems to be, I mean, it's going to be expensive. And we have all these other things that keep getting added to the cost of housing every time we turn around. So to make it easier, I totally get it. Do a panel swap is not, you know, yeah, it's going to cost a little bit of money. But when you watch one of the professionals do it, they do it like that. I wouldn't try it. But and I do agree with Mr. Snope on his point that this type of stuff should be left into the Department of Labor. I mean, Mr. Snope, I think it was October of last year, we were before the State Electrical Board for integrated building material determination, because that's their job. It's legislature people. Very few of you have ever worked in the trades. So for us to sit here and pretend that we know better, or for some people, like, it would be like me making policy for doctors. It's not there. But that's all I had. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Ream. Considering the amount of federal and state subsidies that already exist for electric vehicles, for charging infrastructure, there appears to be new legislation coming every week that we vote on the floor of the House that kind of enhances subsidies and provides access to new revenue sources for the build-out of electric vehicle infrastructure. At what point can we answer the question and say the person who chooses to buy an electric vehicle bears that responsibility?
Representative Ream.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Thank you, Representative Schultz. So like I said, the whole and we can work on the language. I've talked to you know, people about how we can work on the language. We're not trying to be electricians, you know, but we do want to make sure that when we're building these homes, we're building them for the future. And the future does not, it will involve a lot more electric vehicles. So we want to make it, sure, it's going to cost a little bit of money, but down the road, it's going to cost a lot more if we're not designing our homes in preparation for the electrification that's coming. So, like, for me, I have a home that's decades old. So for me to have to retrofit my home is going to cost a lot more money because it hasn't been designed in a way that will be EV ready than it would be if they would have designed the home knowing that possibly I would be buying an EV and I would be installing a higher amp or a higher voltage outlet in my garage. So it's a small cost, I think, that pays down the road. And like I said, the change is here, and I think when we buy a house, we're planning not just for today and tomorrow, we're planning for years down the road. So I think this is a smart way for us to be designing our homes.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I find a point of contention on that, just on the basis of we have plenty of families across the state in every community that struggle with the cost to access of a home. And as those costs for a home increase, it makes it more and more difficult. You know, even for my own home, and I'm blessed, but I don't even have a garage. You know, I wish I had a garage for the sake of my car, for my car that is over 200,000 miles. But frankly, I feel like I represent a good cross-section of my own district. And when we can't even pay for the things that are so basic as paying for a garage, you know, because of the costs involved, how are we supposed to say that because of so many mandates and additional subsidies from the government that we should move forward with another mandate that says that this is the way that it should be built out in every home in the state? That's where I struggle and a reason why I don't support this bill.
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Snope.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This is just a quick question, switching gears. As I'm looking at this, and it's all new residential, new multifamily residential, and new commercial structures, have you and your organization done any, or you know, spent any time sort of figuring out how many jobs this is going to create for your members over the foreseeable future?
Mr. Snow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berg, I have not really done much of that math, but I can tell you that we're really happy to see the word electrification here at the Capitol. So I know that our members who work for the home builders or who work for the electrical contractors or work for the home builders, you know, this will require them to do more work on a home. So I can't really say if it's going to be additional workers or just going to be more work for them, but as electrification takes off in the residential field, I think that the contractors that we've worked for, we'll have to be hiring more people to keep up with the demand.
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Snope. I'm excited for you to do that math. I think this is going to provide a lot of great union family sustaining wage jobs as we move towards taking care of our planet and taking care of our workers. This is a fantastic intersection of that. Thank you.
And Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. The first question I have is actually for you, Chair. Is this going to any other committee stops?
Representative Myers, this is going to be laid over for possible inclusion in our upcoming finance bill.
Okay, thank you. Representative Ream, thank you for bringing this. You know, my colleagues over here were talking a lot about housing, which I actually sit on housing. We got a couple people here that do sit on housing. You talked about the future need. You know, I'd really like to see some work done to this because right now we do have what I believe a more immediate need to be addressing some of the housing issues that we have, which is, you know, building houses, building supportive housing, multi-unit. What I don't like to see is, you know, additional things put on the state building code that's going to make it more expensive. It may be a small dollar amount, but right now, I don't think there's a lack of access for people to put these in their home. And I'm just hopeful that, you know, we can keep our eye a little bit more on the immediate need. And for me, that is, you know, the aspect of, you know, those housing opportunities.
Thank you, Representative Myers. Any further questions? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 3439 as amended be laid over. Thank you for bringing the bill.
Thank you, Chair.
The next bill we have is on the agenda is House File 5338 from Representative Nash, and Representative Myers is filling in for Representative Nash. I heard that. Anyway, I'll move that House File 5338 be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome to the committee. Welcome to your committee.
Yes, thank
Representative
you.
Myers, you want to explain the bill?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Nelson. I do have a A1 amendment if we could look at adopting that first or moving it.
Why don't you move the A1 amendment then?
So the A1 amendment here is just getting it into you know, the form that Representative Nash was looking to get it into. What this does is it, you know, we worked with DLI to confirm that this is going to get it into allowing that pool contractors do have to be licensed to cover the full bill.
So you, Representative Myers moves the A1 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you. So over the past several years, you know, we've seen a lot of increase in investment in, you know, our homes. And one of those investments is people installing pools. You know, we saw in COVID when people couldn't get out, they were thinking of those ways that they could spend more time with family and friends. And one of those was, you know, investing in a pool. So those families that made that investment, they don't take it lightly. I mean, they've got to spend a lot of money. Pools are not cheap. You know, so they have to cut things, if that's vacations. But they do that because they want to build those memories. They want to spend time with friends, family, neighbors. So this bill came about because in 2022, 2023, there were, you know, people across the state that were taking advantage of. A lot of those people, I think upwards of 20 people in Carver, Chaska, Chanhassen, you know, asked to, or, you know, sought to get a pool installed. They prepaid for a pool, and either the pool wasn't even started or the pool was started, not finished. And that left a lot of homeowners high and dry. And I think Nash has a good way of naming bills, so I'm kind of going to call this the high and dry bill. You know, what this bill is going to do, it's going to allow homeowners to recover from the general contractor's recovery fund by adding language to the definition of residential real estate, which would include pools. As I said, this is a large expense that people put, they invest into their homes, and having a way to recover if they were left high and dry, I think is really important to address those hardships. I do have a couple testifiers.
I have a couple testifiers on my list, and I think you made the point. The point was made last week when we had discussion on the raising the limit on the, that the contractors to recover from this have to be licensed contractors. So first person on my list is David Olson. Oh, yeah, we did.
Sorry.
Welcome to the committee, and welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. My name is David Olson. I'm a resident of Carver County, and I'm representing my family and a couple dozen of other families who've been victims of a predatory scam artist who's gone under this guise of a pool installer to harm homeowners and consumers. I'm one of the victims. I lost 3 years of my salary paying this one particular individual a down payment to install a pool for my family. And the experience was awful. And in connecting with many other victims whose lives have been torn apart and dreams have been destroyed, and it's just been an unbelievable experience encountering that. The other piece of this that is just really intriguing to me is I'm also a licensed general contractor. So I myself have to pay for the contractor fund. I have to have continuing education. I have to maintain a license. And for someone who's considered an auxiliary service to install pools, to have no accountability, to have no training requirements, to have no insurance requirements, is a huge gap in the law and leaving homeowners high and dry. And so I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak, but I think that as a state we can do better for our consumers, for our homeowners. And I think that anyone who, you know, is sacrificing or investing six figures to improve their home should have some layer of protection. At the bare minimum, an auxiliary service provider should be required to work with the general contractor, or as we're saying, get a general contractor's license.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony.
Thank you.
The next person I have is Kyle Swenson. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Nelson and committee. My name is Kyle Swenson. Again, here to speak to you as a victim and a member of the public. Full transparency, about 3 hours notice, so I do apologize about lack of professional preparedness here, but wanted to just basically speak to you from our experiences. And the group of individuals that we're here representing, I mean, they're all well-educated members of society that we've all done tremendous research. I had 8 to 10 quotes from different pool providers, and we were a little bit excited when we had the opportunity of a contractor saying he could do it sooner than other ones, because again, with COVID and the spike of needs for these pools, several contractors were 2 years out. And I think he capitalized on that opportunity of people having money, of excitement, and the opportunity to, like I said, do something for their own well-being. And my family directly did make those sacrifices. I sold assets to make money in this other way. My family has made the decision to take less vacations. We don't go out to dinner with friends as often to make it able to afford that luxury that we wanted at our house. We do consider ourselves homebodies. I got 2 kids at home. I was doing it for them. I was raised that same way in a small town where I was safe at home. I had friends come to my house. I was raised that way, and that's how I wanted to raise my kids. And now there's the 17 families just that we know of that are going to be in this burden for years, paying interest rates, loan payments. We know of certain individual families that had inheritances wiped away, took out home equity lines of credit against their house that they're going to be continuing to pay against without the increased asset. And one family, too, they foster children. They sold an RV because they wanted a pool at their house to be more home for their family and their kids, and now have neither. Similar to myself, we sold a boat, and now I have neither, and I'm still paying for it. So it seems like a gray area, like I said, almost like a hole in the system that they're capitalizing on, because they're doing all the work that a contractor would do. They're excavating electrical, plumbing, digging holes, building foundations. I mean, they're doing bigger jobs than ones that are protected by the contractor relief fund. And that just, again, it seems like a miss. So we're here just to kind of speak from the victim side to hopefully see if we can close that gap.
Thank you for your testimony. And to both the testifiers, I feel for what happened here. I've seen the reports on TV, and it was terrible what happened. And that gentleman was a con artist that conned a bunch of people, which is unfortunate. But thank you for your testimony. Thank you. Any further testifiers? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the Labor Committee. My name is Mark Foster, Vice President of Legislative Affairs for Housing First Minnesota. We are a trade association of nearly 1,000 members of the home building industry that have one goal in mind, advancing home ownership opportunities for Minnesotans. Most of our members pay into the Contractor Recovery Fund each and every year as part of a renewal of their license. And last year, the legislature and governor added residential solar contractors to the lengthy list of contractors that pay into the Contractor Recovery Fund, and we supported that final language. And we thank both Representative Nash and Representative Myers for this amended language before you today to add those that build residential swimming pools as well. It's a benefit to both these contractors as well as a reassurance for homeowners going forward. So thank you for your consideration and time today.
Thank you for your testimony. Any further members of the audience need to speak? If not, discussion. Representative Mike Meckler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, and in reference to what Mr. Foster has talked about, I was with the solar thing, because that came up on my first year here in 2019. In that regard, so this thing going forward, this will be not retroactive. It will only be going forward, is my understanding, which was what they were trying to do in 2019. They wanted to go backwards. The only – back with the solar issue, it was – and trying to think all that through, if somebody wanted to put solar panels out in their yard, to me that shouldn't have been in the contract recovery fund part of it. They're required to be a licensed contractor. It was when it was directly applied to the rooftop of the home, or it could be the site as well, because that's the primary part of that. And my only caution is, and I've had this conversation with others, are we going to do landscapers next? Because, I mean, you can easily spend $100,000 on a very nice landscaping project. There can be a lot of engineering involved for, you know, runoff and all that kind of stuff. And these stories are horrible, but at the same time, bad people do bad things, and perhaps one thing the state could do is maybe have a stricter licensing process solely for them, try to weed out these bad actors. But at the end of the day, I'm fine with this. I just, how many things are we going to continue to add to it, and how far away from the actual structure, the primary structure itself, are we going to keep putting into it? But that's my only concerns. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Macklin. Any further questions? If not, thank you. Thank Representative Nash for bringing the bill forward, and thank you for the, and with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 5338 as amended be laid over. Thank you. The next one's House File 5226. Representative Berg. Vice Chair Berg. And this is also being laid over, so if you want to make the motion, and we can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you want me to move it to be laid over?
It's going to be laid over, so make the motion to lay the bill over.
Okay. I make the motion that House File 5226 be laid over for possible inclusion. And I do have an amendment.
And it's our day for amendments. Why don't you move your amendment and explain it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the A2 amendment, which makes two minor adjustments to the underlying bill. It includes any shift, education, duty, or other wage differentials, either scheduled or contractual, effective during the pay period, into Minnesota Statute 181.101, wages, how often paid, along with a substantive right to these wages. Extends the protections for recoupment of these wages to workers covered by a collective bargaining agreement, given they often have limited ability to do so under existing law.
All in favor of the A2 amendment, to put it in the order the author wants, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The ayes have
it. Was 1-1.
Thank you.
I'm assuming the author voted for her bill.
I did.
So proceed to explain the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for hearing this important bill today. House File 5226 is a bill that makes a simple yet profoundly impactful technical change to state statute that would help to prevent the underpayment of shift and other wage differentials duly owed to employees. A wage differential, for those who do not know, is a small increased amount of money an employee earns on top of their base hourly pay, typically for working certain shifts that are challenging to fill, such as night shifts, but can include other aspects of their work, such as working as a charge nurse. I will add that we have been working with DLI and received some feedback on how to further fine-tune this language, and I'll be continuing to work on this bill as it hopefully moves through the committee process in the omnibus. Under current law, if a union employee realizes they have not been paid a duly entitled wage differential rate, they are often told to defer to a collective bargaining agreement's prescribed grievance procedure before being able to recoup lost wages. Unfortunately, this leaves many employees with little recourse to pursue back pay beyond what are oftentimes overly restrictive or extremely short windows in for pursuing a grievance. Every collective bargaining agreement is different. Some allow workers to recoup pay from payroll errors for up to 2 years, while others only provide 2 weeks to file a grievance. This means that for many hourly workers who receive shift differentials, if they have been chronically underpaid for months or years, only to discover they were being paid less than they were owed, legally and contractually speaking, they are only entitled to back pay within the window set forth in the grievance process, which, as I mentioned, could be as short as 2 weeks, resulting in employees potentially losing thousands of dollars. At a time when working families in Minnesota are trying to make ends meet and many workers, especially in healthcare settings, are stretched thin, this bill seeks to ensure that when workers are not paid the wages to which they are entitled, they are entitled to full inclusion in the protections and remedies of our wage protection and theft prevention laws. With that, I believe I have a testifier, Mr. Chair.
I have a Ben Baglio on my list. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record. And proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Ben Balio, and I'm here today with the Minnesota Nurses Association, which represents over 22,000 nurses statewide here. I'm here to testify in strong support of House File 5226 as amended because the underpayment of shift and other wage differentials has long been a destabilizing issue for many nurses and other shift workers, especially in healthcare. As usual, Representative Berg was very on her game as far as the details of this bill, so I'll try not to repeat too much here. But oftentimes when a nurse agrees to work in an undesirable shift, such as a night shift or working as a charge nurse, they'll be entitled to wage differentials in their collective bargaining agreement. However, over the years, there's been instances where our members will work shifts for which they should be entitled to a wage differential, only to discover that the differential had not been applied to their base pay and their paychecks. So for nurses, it can be challenging to keep track of all the differentials and additional pay. And sometimes those things can be unnoticed for a large time. So we've had nurses, sometimes those differentials are anywhere from 25 cents to $2 an hour. And we've had nurses go sometimes months before realizing that that mistake was made. And as Representative Berg alluded to, sometimes the contract only allows them to look back 2 weeks. And so any wages that were not paid to the worker who worked those hours are just kind of lost in the current process. So unfortunately, the only way, as Representative Berg mentioned in her comments, many contracts only allow an employer to file a grievance over the most recent paycheck from the last pay period. And as a result, we've had nurses not be able to go after those wages sometimes up to a year where they feel like they were being shorted pay on their paychecks. So this bill really brings into alignment our with state statutes and our values, where it says if you and your employer agree that you're to be entitled to a certain wage for performing certain work, that you'll be paid that wage. And so as it stands now, that's not the case in our law. It's really hard. There's a lot of work that nurses have to go through to get the pay that they're deserved. And so advancing this protects workers, make sure they get the wages that are deserved, and it'll also save both parties a lot of time and unnecessary grievances over this back pay. So I'd like to thank Representative Berg for her work on this. I hope we can get it done. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Anybody else that needs to speak on this bill? If not, discussion. Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Thank you, Representative Berg. Thank you to the testifier. I'm very familiar with a lot of pay differentials when my wife was in the hospital. And, I'm walking around outside in the middle of the night when the baby can't sleep because she's taken, night shifts, weekend shifts. So, knowing that that'll be addressed, I think is helpful because it is hard to keep track of some of that stuff. The question I had, though, was, outside of nursing, do you see any other pitfalls? For example, are we setting a precedent that employers need to give written notice right away when this would go into effect if you got a raise or a promotion? I can understand it in the aspect of nursing. I'm just trying to figure out in some of these other jobs if there's something that, is either being missed or is being addressed.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Myers. I suppose the most glaring examples do tend to happen in the healthcare industry. I do have an expert here to answer some questions, but that is a really great question, something that I think that we need to make sure we're looking at, because it is very easy as we're all sitting here to kind of think about the different shifts nurses and other healthcare workers work. But there are a lot of industries that have shift differentials, corrections work, that type of thing. So I'd call my expert, Hunter Cantrell, up here to answer the question further if I have not done it justice.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Hunter Cantrell, and it's a pleasure to be here. Mr. Chair, Representative Meyer, do you feel like the question was adequately answered?
Yeah, I mean, what I really did appreciate is maybe offline, Representative Burke, and maybe, I'd love to brainstorm with you just to make sure that there's other instances, because we talk about raises versus pay, differential, which then your pay goes back down. I think that we could maybe look at some clarification, and then maybe outside of healthcare, maybe how this may impact. But, I mean, if there's anything you want to add, that's...
Mr. Cantrell.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Meyer. No, I think that, you know, Representative Byrd put it quite well that, you know, there are many different industries in which workers are paid a pay differential for working undesirable shifts. And I think that as the conversations around this bill continue, that will be explored more. Just make sure that it's comprehensive.
Representative Meyer, any further questions?
And Mr. Chair, just one more point on that question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would love that, Representative Myers, if you want to partner with me on that. We're also continuing to explore this with DLI, so happy to have partnership in that because, you know, I've experienced it in the airline industry where we literally have joked that it's our second job to keep track of our pay because there are so many different factors that go in and especially large companies when they're dealing with the magnitude of payroll that they do, it's up to the employee to make sure we're getting paid what we're paid. And I've experienced having to go to them and work it all out. And, you know, when you're supporting yourself, you have to make sure every penny is there. So I love that you flagged this because I would like to make sure we're reaching as many employees with this as we can.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this certainly isn't my area of specific expertise. However, as my wife and I were preparing for the National Democratic holiday coming on Monday of next week, we were discussing a few of our things and and our family budget, and I just wanted to kind of confirm for you, this is only for like W-2 employees rather than independent contractors. Just wanted to confirm that.
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Schultz. That is my understanding. That's what we're focusing on right now. We don't, I think, have any intent of taking a look at independent contractors. I have been one, so that's kind of an interesting point you make, but I think for the purposes of this bill, it is W-2 employees.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just in response, yeah, my concern is just to ensure that we're having the right amount of regulatory humility for businesses to be able to run appropriately. It's a reason why I wouldn't want to take us down the route of the independent contractor realm. Speaking even like literally for myself as an independent contractor, I wouldn't want to put that additional hamper on a business that is so irregular by nature. So thank you for the discussion, and I do encourage more humility and appreciate the conversation and the dialogue that you're having with Representative Myers.
Any further questions? If not, House Representative Byrd renews her motion that House File 5226 as amended is laid over.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for that. And members, next week, next Tuesday, the 16th, we are going to do a walkthrough of our finance bill, take testimony. And it'll be the DE amendment that'll be, we'll get it out soon. And then on Monday, we'll hopefully get out by Monday. And then after that, on Thursday, we're going to do take up the DE and take the amendments and go from there. And so that's the plan for next week. Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Do we have, what's the budget target for?
So much.
$1 million was our budget target.
Okay. Okay.
Which is probably one of the lower ones that we have. Anything else? Well, nothing else before us? We're adjourned.